Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about episode 4 of New Scientist 2019, April the 6th. I've just read an article about free will. It was sort of unsurprising that it went back to the maths of complex interrelating systems, where you have a small sort of complex behavior emerging from systems following small rules. Now, it's hard to say, going through that, I immediately thought of the meta-organisms. So you've got a human organism, but we've got a meta-organism of a whole nation, which behaves as individual units making decisions. And so this process mimicked inside the brain is mimicked outside. It doesn't mean it can't be analysed. I suppose I found it interesting that this person thought that this is a great... He realised it and it was part of a great discovery, whereas I think perhaps scientists working in the field would say, oh, well, it's exists already, we're just uncovering it. They wouldn't... It's very interesting, people putting themselves forward as a proponent of an idea. Whereas I think that really stops you, because if you put yourself a proponent of an idea, you support that idea, and whether you can let it go or not. Now, we have the next article here. Has religion been good or bad for humanity? So religion, again, going forth on this, is a system of folk beliefs. So a folk belief is one which is not necessarily testable by experiment. Doesn't hold up to experiment, and is a belief of the people, reinforced, kept in check by the people. So a folk belief is a belief where people dress up, have a whole lot of social... it's a belief sustained by social interactions, whereas a scientific belief is something sustained by experiment, repeatability. So a folk belief... which may be incorrect, can have all the trappings of a scientific belief, i.e. it's been held for a long time, people place importance to it, that is, scientific beliefs are held for a long time, people take its importance, but it may nonetheless be an incorrect belief, and it's got these characteristics that people often, when they talk about it, instantly talk about the rank of where it came from. Now, it's not to say that people can't talk about scientific beliefs in that way, especially if you're a folk person, you know, in the system, you'll say, well, such and such a scientific belief is true because such and such a scientist said it. So there's that sort of folk, that folk belief system can go over to the scientific system and obscure the folk belief system's view of science, but sort of science is standalone, whereas folk beliefs require a society around it. Now, the fact that people in the folk area can actually build a folk belief system around science doesn't not mean that science itself is a folk thing. It can be described in folk terms. But on the other hand, your folk beliefs in general come into conflict with science, and they're persistent, that is, the reason that they exist is that they're handed from person to person through systems, and this system hands the belief but also the authority, the importance, the network aspect of it. That's just my view. Now, we'll just have a look at this article. It says, an epic scientific analysis of history would finally settle the question of how religion influenced the rise of civilization. Well, my think is that religion is like a separation of power. That is, it's the culture that you would assume with a powerful person that's been transferred across to a mythical thing. It's also got the advantage that this idea of supervision, that people will know about things. It subdues independent action, because you believe that there is a spiritual being looking at your every consequence. So you can imagine in Hunter the Gallera things, you've got this religious belief which is as a scaffold for your behaviour. So you go across the mountain, you don't start thinking independently. You've got that downloaded app or algorithm in your head controlling how you think, and then when you come back, it can be modified, but it's modified in a coherent way. It's a centralized modification rather than delocalized modifications, which lead to bifurcations. So it's a very useful mechanism for if you've got a group of people who are going to change activities, or they're going to migrate places, or they're going to move on a migratory path back and forth. It also links into programming. Often animals will program that fur coat, that have scent and stuff like that. Humans began to they'd go into a system, they wouldn't evolve fast enough, so they would see seasons and they'd develop their the sun rising, that developed festivities, which would mean that having a series of festivities and religion would find a basic sort of clockwork for them to actually move forward and go through the processes. So now that we've got apps, Google Calendar and stuff like that, in the old places you'd have the Feast of Middle March, the Feast of St. Michaelmas, these various feast days, the harvest feast days, and this would act as a coordinating app. So religion had an app. This is the folk belief. So you believed the big person in the sky was going to make this fertile if you did these various things. And simply because it was illogical, it had the ability to be recrafted. If it didn't work, you did something wrong, you could ascribe, if you dislike someone, you could ascribe a failure to that person in a way they couldn't respond to it. This is sort of like the folk belief of alienating. So you'd have to buy into the folk belief system, or the folk system would become toxic to you and push you out, which is another aspect to our groups. I think you should look actually the religion turning on other groups and breaking up is causing separation, migration. This is going into it. If you look at the cellular form of humanity, it tends to bud and separate and repel each other. Groups are repelled from each other, so they escape to fertile lands with other humans in it. That's out of humans. That would be ideal to expand. So other humans repel other humans, that they fight and repel each other. So religion as a way of causing exclusion, but the exclusion actually creates people. So you actually look at, say, America's, Pilgrim Fathers are religious refugees. There's religious stories for all these things coming up, and these people in Australia, of course, we had the convicts out, but we also had an inflow of religion, which then pushed society apart. And so religion's ability to fragment society is actually a good thing, because it's for an expansion model, a conquest model, because it means that by actually one group grasping resources, it leaves the group without resources, so eventually they butt off and find new resources. So you can say that religion is perhaps, in its coupling with an expansion model, is coming to an end, as we are running out of the resource draw of the planet is beginning to disappear. We've got to think of a new model for religion. And as religion itself has got so many mechanisms, ancient mechanisms, to get a group of people who are not technologically connected but behaviourally connected, i.e. there's a priest, there's a set of behaviour you go, and there's a set of programs that you go. So you have a religious calendar, activities with that calendar associated with it. As that begins to unravel a bit, because people can say, I've got my own calendar, I've got my own money, my own finances, I can if you don't like me, I can withdraw for a while. I'm actually living much longer. My lifespan is not 35, it's 200. It's a factor of 3 times greater lifespan. It's pretty incredible. Religion not necessarily can't cope with that, but it's also the mathematics of it to see if I want to do something. I would, in ancient times, for Augustus, the August speaker, the people, if you could speak an argument and people could win the argument, that would be it. It would be end of the story. So if I believe something and I win the argument, then people can't think the other way. It's hard to imagine. There was no silent reading and no silent thought. Thought was a collective idea. So this is something that few historians understand, that going back, their thought was a collective idea. And so you have these ancient fossil institutions where there's a collective idea, that people have a collective idea and it's across. And if I say it loud enough and often enough times in meetings or staff development, if I say something, it has to be true, which is that ancient religious way of saying it. But it means that this is one mechanism, and it's like an equation in a class of equations, a class of solutions. You can imagine other solutions which will operate beyond the sequence. So the entire idea of a religion is that it is propagated year after generation, doesn't change. And if you know that process, it's got to invest a certain amount of energy into propagating a certain fraction of it. It's got to be cautious that it reproduces. So religion is a reproducing thought process, obviously. Like Christianity, from the time of Christ, has lasted to our time. It has evolved, but it has also reproduced and gone down certain lines. It's absorbed certain things and transformed, but it's essentially reproduced. So in order to reproduce, you can't say, right, we're going to stop worrying about our next generation. We're going to worry about 10 generations ahead. We're going to prepare a set of doctrines which is going to be relevant to them. And of course, that's not going to work as effectively as someone who said, well, forget the future. I'm just going to focus on meeting the current needs and the needs next week and stuff like that, which means that your clientele keep on. It's a socially based thing, whereas scientific research can be at a concept which may be relevant in 100 years' time. You know, there's certain aspects which are leapfrogging, and of course, the religious viewpoint can't actually comprehend people going back through the scientific records and saying, oh, look, that's an important thing. I think we can bring that forward. That entire process is an anathema to them. So let's read what Harvey Whitehouse has to say. This is an article, and I have spoken there for 13 minutes as an introduction. Religion, I must admit that this is the entire aim. I'm trying to break this up and really push myself in communication. And I'm aware that I'm doing one aspect of communication. I've now got to listen and work out what people do. Religion has given us algebra and the Spanish Inquisition. Oh, I suppose religion, this is because Muhammad, in order to move away from a folk belief, which was interpretable and gameable, he recast the the Quran. He gave specific, almost scientific formulas for the moon goes up at this point in the thing, you can do that. So he actually forced, by moving the Muslim religion a step away from God said, God now says that when the moon is seen at such and such a point, such and such a thing can happen. So he locked us into the calendar and stuff like that. It meant that it was sort of a quasi-scientific step, believed in there, taking yourself away from that viewpoint. But therefore, that led to algebra, and algebra is named after the actual bloke, Al Gibra. I know. Okay. In the Spanish Inquisition. Barks, Canatas, and Pogroms, which is a beautiful story because this is a code of people saying we want to repel these people. They can't move along. They've irritated us, and this process of normal expulsion of people would do it. This is the have and have nots. In order to pogrom is not as much as killing one relief. It's actually propagating your own relief. If you get someone to murder someone, that they're obviously stuffed, intellectually stuffed. Go across. So pogrom refers to where they used to round up Jews and kill them at various points in time. The debate over whether religion lifts humanity's high or brings out our best instincts is ancient and, in some ways, reassuringly insoluble. I would say it's actually soluble. There are so many examples of either side, the last word goes to the most erudite until someone more erudite comes along. Well, there you go. Well, that's because in a religious process, the word, it is the last word of a person. So this is interesting going through here. It's in a religious process. It's the most erudite person because knowledge is intertwined with humanity rather than being separate from. Okay, the last round of the eternal conundrum was triggered by the seemingly religious-inspired 9/11 attacks in the US, after which the new atheists rose to prominence. The likes of evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins and neuroscientist Sam Harris argue that rational beings follow the evidence must inevitably conclude that religion is harmful. They, in turn, have been accused of cherry-picking the evidence. I don't think it's harmful. Well, my view is it's an algorithm that causes certain things. There's certain behaviours. It's like it's almost as though a scientist is being popped into some apes, right? And the apes have a system of doing. You can actually go about your way without getting mugged by decoding it. You might conclude that it is impossible to make moral judgments about the multifaceted cultural phenomena. Nevertheless, in recent years, there have been attempts to dissect the questioning using scientific scalpel. Researchers have tried to work out how humanity has been shaped by things like moralizing philosophies, world religions, all-seeing gods, and rituals. Okay, so for me at this stage, the all-seeing god is the way that you can... If you've got a belief, it gives the persistence and the immutability of belief. You can go back and say, I thought that, well, your thought's wrong. Your evolutionary thought's wrong, and your thought can actually operate when you're separate in a way. So you can send someone out from a tribe. It's sort of like this lasting view that's moralizing. And rituals, obviously, is a way of... if you put someone through a ritual, it allows them, it's a way of, it's sort of an unwritten way of giving someone a license to do something or practicing something or getting a conscious, that is bringing out conceptual things and bring it into a mechanical way to program people forward. So you perform a ritual before harvesting, so it gets everyone together, gives a plan, it sort of unifies it. It's very interesting. It's also interesting in that education, people eventually see it, or some people see it as only as a sequence of rituals. There's a ritual of this school assembly, there's an awards, there's a ritual of giving. There's a very ritual, a rite-oriented thing. The studies offer intriguing insights, but each presents just a fragment of the full story, and sometimes they generate competing ideas. Wow, that's a genius person who said that. What is needed is a way to assess them and build a more holistic picture of the whole religion, of the role religion has played in the evolution of human societies, and that is what I and my colleagues have been doing. Well, yes, isn't that amazing? Because you've got the person, you need to communicate into the folk stuff. Look, there's there's about 20 parrots. I've never seen this before. Okay, if you wanted to hear that, that's parrots fighting. It was about four parrots up in a tree having a territorial fight. There's a school compost bin which these mangy, the most mangy, ugly parrots. They're, you know, amazingly, parrots are lethal. This is just an aside. So there's this pariasis, and this person turned up in Katoomba Hospital. A couple of people turned up at Katoomba Hospital, and what did they do? They kissed a parrot. They kissed a parrot, a live parrot. Some of these parrots that look really beautiful, the most multicolored, beautiful birds you can see, but you see a good parrot and you see a bad, mangy parrot. You know, it's interesting to see a bad mangy parrot and they all go over it. A bad mangy, a bin parrot. Okay. So this, it's interesting that these authors are placing themselves back into that folk system of saying, I'm an author, I'm a things. Moral quicksand. But first, what do we mean by good and bad? Should religion be considered good if it's inspired magnificent art but enslaved millions? And this is another important thing, is that modern civilization got up with the domestication of plants and itself. Civilization is an enslavement, and religion can stabilize enslavement because you've got to have a uniform slave thing. You know, everyone, you go to a door and everyone in society has the same belief. If someone has a different belief, you can actually be a weak link in the chain. Would it be judged bad if it ensured equality at the price of free expression? Such assessment risks marring us in moral quicksand. Besides, how could intangibles be weighted against one another? A more empirical approach might tell you the lives lost or harmed against those saved and enhanced by as a result of religion. I think we can say that religion and technology and a whole series of things are led to us essentially destroying the planet, but any attempt to estimate these numbers would be hopelessly subjective. Oh, God. Alternatively, we can ask whether religion has helped societies grow and flourish. It is, as many believe, a form of social glue that binds and cooperation. I would say so. But if as much as every flourished religion, let's say it really helped the Romans, no, it didn't. The Romans are all dead. Really helped the Greeks? Oh, no, they're all gone. Really helped Genghis Khan? Oh, no, they've all gone. So it helps in the build-up, but also means that the solutions aren't at hand to stop decay, I would say, as in general. But I do think we may be technologically getting ahead of things. As it happens, there is surprising agreement about the moral significance of cooperation. A study of 60 societies ranging from small groups to the very large has found that people everywhere equate good with cooperative behaviour and bad with non-cooperative ones. Yeah, that's exactly. You're not cooperating with the big thing. You're bad. You get expelled and pushed around like that. Admittedly, society is different in the kinds of cooperation they value. Some more authoritarians, others more egalitarian. Nevertheless, this approach allows us to ask more tangible questions about religion. What role, if any, has it played in establishing the cooperative behaviours that allowed human societies to grow from small hunter-gatherer groups to vast empires or nation-states? Well, I would say that's one aspect. The aggregation aspect of religion is important, but also the separation, the fact that you've got two groups and they hate each other and religion allows them to bud off and the other religious sect goes across. So Australia's got, you know, obviously the Pommy people, but it's also got little groups of Germans and people that who are running away. Not the running away from the Nazis, they were running away from religious persecution back in Germany. Who would have believed it? Angela Merkel, come on down. Okay. One obvious place to begin is the Axial Age, a period when many researchers believe civilization pivoted towards modernity. What is the Axial Age? Around the middle of the first millennium BC, as the thinking goes, a set of cultural changes swept the world. Novel notions of equality radically altered the relationship between rulers and the ruled, stabilizing society and allowing them to leap in both size and complexity. That is really fascinating because, again, that's the Spartan stuff. You know, looking at that, Sparta took one route, and that is, I think, very interesting. Why the axle age? Well, the axle age. The religion is thought to have played a role in this. Indeed, the axle age concept emerged from the observation of a handful of important prophets and spiritual leaders from Buddha, Confucius, Zoroaster, Zarathustra. I thought Zarathustra was completely niche, but that's Zoroastrian. All rose. It's interesting. There we go, a big picture. Oh my god. To prominence in that period, preaching similar moralistic ideologues. Another popular hypothesis is the cooperation of complex society is intimately connected with the invention of big gods, deities who demand their moral code be observed by all and who have supernatural powers of surveillance and enforcement. Well, I couldn't agree with that more. Most of today's world's religions have these moralizing gods, but they are rare in smaller scale societies where supernatural beings tend to care only whether people discharge their obligations to the spirit world. 100%. And I think you've got to actually understand the folk belief. You don't have to scratch very much before they actually believe in spirits. And this is even rational people. They believe, they'll say, oh, this is an authority, I don't know who said this. They all check this idea of surveillance. It's amazing how the spirit world has come into the internet. It has been suggested that the establishment of big states with larger urban populations depended on belief of such gods who cared about how everyone, including the relative strangers, treated each other. Big gods could also have helped solve the problem that plagues every society beyond a certain size, free riders. In small communities, it's relatively easy for a peer group and local chiefs to catch people who try to live off the fruits of society while contributing less than their fair share. Okay, you can look at free riders, or you can determine people are free riders, they're trying to do their best, they just don't gel, and you can expel them, which unfortunately buds them off and pushes them away. In bigger ones, the impersonal transaction is the more commonplace, the compliance is harder to police. Here, the fear that moralizing gods is watching will punish free riders, for example, the eternal damnation, to keep help do the trick. Our researchers, including me, have examined the role of sacred rituals might have a social clue. I certainly believe this. For most prehistory, humans lived in small groups whose members all knew each other. Today, small-scale societies tend to favor infrequent but traumatic rituals promote intense social coherence, the kind that is necessary for people to risk life and limb hunting dangerous animals together. That's right. So you've got a ritual sort of means that there's that fear thing, and then that fear thing can go, that ritual pain can be the pain endured in killing an animal. It's really good. Example would be the agonizing initiation rite carried out the septic region of Papua New Guinea involving extensive sacrifice of the body to resemble the skin of a crocodile, a locally revered species. However, in the inadvertent farming, such rituals are no longer fit for purpose. The farming supported large populations whose members didn't always know each other. They also, which is the thing is, for farming, you have to enslave people. They also weren't required to risk everything for one another, so they didn't require the same levels of social cohesion. But they did feel a need to be part of a group obeying the same moral code of systems of governance, especially societies absorbed other ethnic groups through military conquest. Very important. So religion is your war chest. You come with the invading soldiers, you come rape some of the women, and then you implant your religion to keep it in cemented. New kinds of rituals seem to provide the shared identity. These generally painless practices such that prayer and meeting are holy places that could be performed frequently and collectively, allowing them to be duplicated across the entire state empire. Is that churches are built, masses are said to form, it's really interesting. A puzzle, however, is that many of these early civilizations also practiced the brutal rituals of human sacrifice. Or sacrifice in general. You had to kill an animal, and so you had the problem that, I don't know. This reaches its zenith in so-called archaic states that existed between 3000 and 1000 BC, were among the cruelest and the most unequal societies ever. In some parts of the globe, human sacrifice persisted until relatively secretly. An Inca religion, for example, had much in common with today's world religions. People paid homage to their gods, frequent and for the most part painless ceremonies. But their rulers had divine status. Their gods weren't moralizing, and their rituals included human sacrifice, rites up to the time conquered by the Spanish in the 16th century. But it's hard to say they actually believed that the sun was inside, and they had to release the sun by getting the heart out. The Axle Age, Big Gods, Rituals, how can we test these ideas? In 2010, Peter Francois at the University of Oxford and Peter Turinch at the University of Connecticut and I began building a history databank. Wow. This project named Sheshet after the Egyptian goddess of record keeping. Oh, now that is cute. Sheshet. A record keeping. The Egyptian goddess of record keeping? Sheshet. Prizes the introduction of data to investigate these hypotheses rigorously and on a global scale. To date, it contains information on more than 400 societies that have existed around the world over the past 10,000 years. Just so it keeps growing. I believe it's now mature enough to tackle the question of whether religion has been good or bad for humanity. In research published last year, I was part of a team that used Sheshet to explore the Axle Age idea. Advocates of the concept, we were in for a surprise. For a start, many features characteristic of the age, including moralistic norms and legal codes, are raised in places far from the influences of those spiritual leaders, and sometimes long before the middle of the first millennium. In what is now Turkey, for example, the Hittites adopted a moral code about the millennia early. What is more, various features of the Axle Age didn't come together until much later than most scholars had thought, many thousands of years after the initial emergence of large-scale complex society. For a long time, Zarathustra preached in Iran, the divinely sanctioned powers or ruler remained unchecked, for example. The Confucian didn't take off in China until after 200 BC. It would appear that these moralizing ideologies weren't directly linked with the rise of sizable cooperative civilizations. Well, this is the entire thing, the evolution of religion. It goes almost like an organism life form, and if it's not fit to go in, it goes off to the side and breeds, and then it's plucked. It's not so much conquest, it's coerced. So if you look at the Mongol leaders and the various leaders that were going forward, they were asking for different religions. I think the Bulgarians, going up from Constantinople, were asking, well, can we have a religion? Yeah, it's like shopping for a religion online. There was also like an eBay religion or a Alibaba religion. Just click on this one, you'll have it. You'll be have the fit purpose. It's like a machine. People understand the machine. Sort of about big gods. Were they required by society to scale up? In research published by Nature, obviously, a large interdisciplinary team of scholars, including Patrick Savage of Keio University in Tokyo, Francois Turchin and me, used Sheshet to test this idea. We measured social complexity using 51 markers such as population size and the presence of bureaucracy and money, and found that in most all of the regions we analysed, moralising gods were adopted much later than expected. Instead of helping foster cooperation, society expanded, big gods appeared only after society had passed the threshold of complexity corresponding to a population around 1 million people. Now, this is interesting because it says it's sort of like you've got the need and the, yeah, like we've created God, we've got this need, and now we've created the aspects of God which fit that need. Whereas people had something, the God may have been slightly different, but it's like the God has been formed and sucked in. This first happened in Egypt, where the people believed in the supernatural enforcement order of or Maat, personified by goddess as Sesat. What's the name of that thing? Sesat. personal McDonald's as early as 280 BC. Egypt had a population of 1.1 million at the time and was, by all measures, the most sophisticated society in the world. The most parsimonious explanation is that something other than big gods allowed societies to grow. Our study suggested that that something was a shift in nature of rituals from the traumatic and rare painless and rare to the painless and repetitive. Yeah, you can imagine that. The other thing is that you've got, you know, one person having pain, and the other thing is you've got an isolated group of people suffering pain. So my viewport, but I think we still have a religious thing in which a bully bullies someone and causes observable pain to everyone. So I think we do have the painful religion, and that's bullying to go across here. Are you okay there, Rupert? We predated the big gods in 9 of the 12 religions we studied by 1,100 years on average, giving rise to the first doctrinal religions, the forerunners of today's world of religions. But there was a dark side to this development, human sacrifice. It's interesting because I think there is human sacrifice in some of these corporations where they select, we're going to sacrifice that person in front of each other. And I think the aspect is not that you killed a person, that everyone else around cannot save a person. So rather, it provides an alternative exit. One is you can banish someone or you can kill them internally. And what sort of amazed me is the idea of crucifixion. The crucifixion was painful, but it was also very public, and you could actually walk around it for a time, and no one could. It was a sort of power, a communication of power, because you have this instinct to do it, and your brain could either not function ever perfectly after it, or you could get back to life as normal, but with this crucifixion, it's sort of like a traumatization. And I was interested in Aristotle. Aristotle was had a ruler who got crucified by the Persians. This is 300 years before Christ, so crucifixion was there, and had the process of taking a ruler up, forcing society not to, breaking that social connection with that ruler, and therefore allowing you to be reprogrammed. So it's like this break and reprogramming. So killing someone is reprogramming, and as with when a CEO comes into a company, they inevitably pick on the weakest, and they have a very public thing where the company cannot support that weak person, and it means it's reprogramming. Despotic god kings. Now this is another interesting thing, that kings believe they're gods. In a 2016 study based on the historical analysis of more than 100 small-scale societies in Austronesia, and concluded that human sacrifice was used as a form of social control. The elites, chiefs, and shamans did the sacrificing, the lower orders paid the price, and so maintained social stability by keeping the masses terrorized and subservient. Shisham includes much bigger societies, and yet to be published analysis indicates that practice started to decline when the populations exceeded about 10,000. At this point, when the rulers were finding it necessarily increasingly difficult to police the masses, human sacrifice may become a destabilizing force, providing incentive for people to revolt against the system. Society began to fracture, making it vulnerable to conquest. Piecing this all together, here is what we think happened. As society grew by means of agricultural innovation, the infrequent dramatic rituals were kept. They had to get people together as small foraging bands gave way to frequent, painless ones. These early doctrinal religions helped unite larger heterogeneous populations just enough to overcome the free-riding problems which installed compliance with new forms of governance. However, in doing so, they rendered them vulnerable to a new problem, power-hungry rulers. These were despotic god-kings who presided over archaic states. Granted the divine right to command vast populations, they exploited it to raise militias and priesthoods, shoring up their power through practices we nowadays regard as cruel, such as human sacrifice and slavery. Well, I think slavery came along before that. But archaic states rarely grew beyond 100,000 people because they in turn became internally unstable and therefore less defensible against invasion. Societies that expanded to a million or more were those who found their new way to build a cooperation with big gods. They demoted their rulers in moral status, laid the seeds of democracy and the rule of law, and fostered a more egalitarian distribution of rights and obligations. To our modern eyes, bad religions gave way to good ones. In reality, religions are always good in the sense that they promoted cooperation. They changed. What changed was society began valuing social justice above defense of authority. In other words, they changed their ideas about what constituted good cooperative behaviors to one that are more closely aligned with our modern agendas. Today, many societies have transferred religious community building and surveillance roles to secular institutions. I couldn't agree more. Some of the wealthiest and most peaceful have atheist majorities. But some of these same societies are also facing grave problems as they absorb migrants and struggle to contain the growing social tensions and xenophobia. Time will tell if they are capable of adapting to meeting the challenges of these destabilizing influences, but analysis, the kind we are doing, could at least reveal the elements of religions have pushed us towards our modern notion of civilization that so might be worth emulating. Look, I think one graph would do it. I mean, there must be more to it. Profile: Harvey Whitehouse is chair of the Social Anthropology and director of the Centre for Study of Social Cohesion at the University of Oxford. A founder of cognitive science of religion, he is known for his idea of modes of religiosity, which explains how frequently an emotional intensity of collective rituals influence the scale and structure of organisations. Yeah. It's interesting that I'm surprised education is full of ceremonies. They have lots of ceremony, people dressing up on stage, choirs of religious singing, music, and what's the purpose of it? You know, like if you, yeah, it's a thing of authority, sort of like human sacrifice. Northern sounds. The enduring mystery of Aura's ghostly voice have been solved, David Hemmings reports. Late one evening, a jazz festival in the remote village of Saareslykia in northern Finland, Uno Lund and his friends decided to go outside and watch the auroras borealis and listen to the silence. It was minus 35 degrees, completely still, and the northern lights played overhead. We all started to listen without talking, without moving, and almost without breathing, says Lorraine. They wanted to hear how quiet it could be with no traffic, no wind, and everyone asleep. To their surprise, the silence was total. The group became aware of a faint background noise, a sort of hissing that seemed to change synchrony with the movements of the aura. We started to discuss whether these sounds would be caused by the aura. We all agreed, no way, to the rain. The aura was so high and the sounds created there could not be audible on the ground. That was 1990. Lorraine forgot about the resulting rustling aura until he revisited a jazz festival in 1999. 9 years later. He once again found himself puzzled by the mysterious sound. He may not have been the first person to be intrigued by the phenomenon, but he was perhaps the best place to solve it. Lorraine studies psychoacoustics, the science of sound and how we perceive it. At Aalto University in Helsinki, he has now spent as much past 20 years fighting to prove the aura simply isn't a feast for the eyes, it's magic in the ears as well. The northern lights occur with charged particles from the sun collide with the Earth's atmosphere. Sure, you'd be able to be picked up with a microphone, but psychoacoustics might be brain waves. At the poles, the orientation of a planet's magnetic fields can allow the particles to penetrate the upper layers. That is, the poles are at 90 degrees to the orbit. Okay, so the pole points away and towards the sun, so twice at the winter. Not the winter solstice, that's not that. The equinox, the hardest. Penetrate the upper atmosphere and excite gas molecules 80 kilometres over our head. the molecules get rid of their excess form of light, green or red for oxygen, blue or purple for nitrogen. This is the important thing, is to know that these are metastable states. That's why they glow. It's not necessarily the iron, it's the molecules. Most auroras watchers never hear anything. Sounds are lost in background noise, like... okay. Okay. Traffic and people talking. It is physic to watch a perfect silence, as Lorraine Scrip did. But some clearly had found a long history of accounts of oral sounds from indigenous people in the northern latitude, as well as scientific reports going back more than 300 years. A list compiled in 1931 quotes one listener hearing a swishing or rustle like a silken skirt. Another said it was the sound made when a couple of slices of good fat bacon are dropped in a red-hot pan. A third compared the oral sounds to a flock of birds flying close to one's head. Others described a very continuous faint whistling sound and even loud reports of rifle cracks. Physicists looking to replicate these observations weren't so lucky. Oral sounds were problematic for two reasons, says Dirk Lumbersman, University of Alaska. Every attempt to record or observe the sound with technical equipment had failed, says Lumbers, and there was no known mechanism that could explain the sound that the people reported. Seen but not heard. That led some to suggestion that the sound was an auditory illusion caused by seeing the aura, or even a result of synesthesia, in which the activation of one sense can trigger another. To Lane, this was dismissing the observation simply because they were hard to explain. What if the Canadian First Nation Inuits and Sami people and those Mennonites living in northern Siberia are right, he asked Lorenz. Instead of blaming the observers for making errors or having synesthesia, shouldn't we scientists be studying this phenomenon to solve the mystery? In 2000, Lorenz started a project to do just that with Finland's Sodianska Geophysical Observatory and Center for Expertise in Auroral Burials. A major goal was to record the sound of aurora for the first time. This was challenging because it wasn't clear what the sound was or where it was coming from. It took a long time to discover all the ambient sound comes, sounds and trajectory, says Lang. The issue of this was the challenge of finding funding for, and a lack of wider interest meant that it wasn't until 2010 that Lorraine captured his first recording of auroral sounds. For those who had taken oral sound seriously, the recording contained a surprise. Many had speculated the noises were due to ground objects acting as electromagnetic receivers, many aerials vibrating in response to the great light shows overhead. Lorraine was skeptical. Quote, observers have talked for hundreds of years about sounds being, quote, in the air, not from the ground of treetops, he says. His psychoacoustics background encouraged him to believe these reports. Lorraine Lane findings ultimately backed them up. The sounds were coming from the air itself, from altitudes less than 100 metres. Human hearing is very good at localization of sound sources, and this part of the reports had not been taken seriously. So why are these auroral sounds arise? Lane believes the origin lies in the phenomenon known as coronal discharge, similar to the process responsible for audible sparks and static shock. These discharges are often seen high-voltage electrical equipment and form a blue glow around the pointed metal objects, often accompanied by a buzzing sound. To generate the current voltages required, you need to build up a lot of positive and negative charge in very close proximity. I can imagine that. Lorraine's proposal is that this can happen at very still evenings, when the frozen ground begins to cool the air immediately above it. The result is that the higher layer of warm air with several hundred meters of cool air trapped below. The negative ions close to the ground rise up to the layer of the interface known as the inversion layer, but are prevented from rising above it. Meanwhile, the positive ions settle on the upper surface. The electrical potential already significant is increased further by the aurora, says Lorraine, up until the point where the sudden aurora discharge happens. This produces ultraviolet radiation, magnetic field pulses, and sounds. This theory elegantly accounts for why the sounds occur only during particular weather conditions. And without an inversion layer, there's no sounds, however bright the aurora display. And when the sounds do appear, they are always at similar altitudes. Lorraine proposed mechanism does seem plausible, says Daniel White, a space physicist at the University of Southampton, UK. But not everybody is convinced. Most scientists still ignore the oral sounds, says Lumsdenholm, and those who do accept it tend to favour the synesthesia as an explanation. Quote, what is needed for another research is to try to duplicate Lance's experiment and design independent experiments to test the inversion layer hypothesis. However, Lane is delighted at the progress towards vindicating all those reports previously dismissed as illusory. A new page is turned in the long history, he says, and those who made valid observations of these sounds can now be proud. So, I mean, obviously, there'd be a recording of it, and you could, yeah, surely this way, you can get a blind person to listen to it. Get rid of the sensations, yeah. We're up to 50 minutes, so I'm going to push myself a little bit further. My godfather. The legacy of culture, legacy of a hunger. We are surprised when animals seem to have inner lives, asks. Why, asks Michael Bond. This is a book review. Mama's Last Hug, the animal's emotions and what that teaches us about ourselves. Until recently, it was heretical for biologists to argue that animals behave a mental life. Because animals can't tell us what they're feeling, most scientists thought it's safest to assume they don't feel much at all, or that their behaviour is derived from simple instincts or learning, emotions, empathy, intelligence. We consider exclusively human traits as they were defined us as humans. Franz de Waal, who has been studying the behaviour of primates for more than four decades, has always opposed this view, which is still prevalent in some circles. For him, there's never been any questions that animals experience the same emotions as humans. Quote, why did we go out of our way to deny and deride something so obvious? And quote, he asked in his latest book, Mama's Last Hug, written before he retires this year. Quote, considering how much animals act like us, share our physiological reactions, have the same facial expressions, and possess the same sorts of brains, wouldn't it be strange indeed if their internal experiences were radically different? The title of De Waal's book refers to the final reunion between Mama, a dying 58-year-old chimpanzee, and Ivan Hoff, a 79-year-old biologist who had known her for 40 years. A YouTube video of this event has been watched for 10 million views since it was posted in 2016. When she realizes who he is, Mama rouses herself from her lethargy, grins expansively, and embraces Van Hoff. It's hard not to interpret her reaction as sheer joy. As Vandal believes, what we that we are right to do so. Instead of tiptoeing around the emotions, it's time for us squarely to face the degree which all animals are driven by them, he writes. So it's a dying chimpanzee, pretty old chimpanzee, pretty old man. In 1872, Charles Darwin made a similar point in the expression of emotion in man and animals. Despite its initial success, this book was overlooked by scientists for more than a century. Discomforted by Darwin's reference to affectionate cats, disappointed chimps and happy cows, they championed human exceptionalism, the idea that we are cognitively superior species. As De Waal writes in Mama's, it's interesting, the happy cow produces better milk. It's an amazing thing. So, essentially, apparently, a good cheese taker can actually pick a abusive farmer. They can taste. I really don't know. Isn't that amazing? There's nothing fundamental about Val's position. Okay, that's three. As De Waal writes in Mum's Last Hung, this was not only corrupted by understanding of animals, but also by ourselves. There is nothing sentimental about Van der Waal's position, and he draws the line at conjecturing about how animals feel, how they subjectively experience their emotions. I'm not for assuming that species related to us have related feelings, but we should not overlook the leap of faith that it takes us, that asks us to take. All things he has learnt about animals have come from observation. He is a brilliant observer and is often amazed by what he sees. He was among the first to understand the importance of reconciliation among apes after watching two rival male chimps make up over a fight by grooming each other's behinds. hours spent criticizing submissive grins of monkeys and playful grunts of chimps helped him and his colleagues unpick the separate evolutionary origins of smiling and laughter. And his analysis of thousands of facial experiments amongst chimps colony in New York's National Primate Research Center in Atlanta, Georgia, where he works, revealed how quickly animals shift from one emotional state to another. If the traits sound familiar, that's the point. Animal emotions are human emotions, even if some of them are more developed in us. It would be surprising if any of our emotions were uniquely human, given that they arise from changes in the body, and DeVal reminds us that all mammalian bodies are essentially the same. So what does this emotional continuum tell us about ourselves? Great ape societies vary considerably in their behaviour, so take your pick. Primatologist Richard William has argued that the violence in chimp societies implies warfare is innate in humans. But the standout feature of our species is arguably the ability to cooperate and keep the peace, which makes us more like bonobos. These are the over six chimpanzees. Nevertheless, we are not higher order version of either species. It is a more complex than that because we share a common ancestor and much more besides. Despite what DeVal calls anthropodenial of people such as neuroscientist Joseph DeLuris, who prefers the science to avoid any allusion to animal emotions despite having spent many hours studying fear in rats, he is optimistic that attitudes have largely shifted from him. For him, the study of emotions is a new frontier in science of animal behavior. DeVal even envisions a new science of animal feelings, a study of animal private experiences, but not yet. For the moment, it's enough that we take seriously what is available on the outside. Okay, I'm just going to push myself over the hour limit here. The beat goes on. Darwin believed in musicality of animals. The truth is much more interesting, says Simon Ings. Evolving animal orchestra in search of what makes us musical. Quote, the perception, if not the enjoyment of musical cadences, stand and rhythm, wrote Darwin in 1871, the book The Desert of Man. It's probably common in all animals, which obviously songbirds, and my daughter used to sing to the rabbit. Hedrick Horning has tested this eminently reasonable idea in his book, The Evolving Animal Orchestra. He reports back his detail. He details his disappointment, frustration, and downright failure with such rich humanity and love of the chase that any young person reading it will surely want to run away to become a cognitive scientist. No culture has yet been found that doesn't have music, and all music shares certain universal characteristic melodies composed over seven or fewer discrete pitches, a regular beat, a limited sequence of rhythmic patterns, all would suggest a biological basis for musicality. A bird flies with regular beats of its wings, animals walk with a particular rhythm, so you might expect the perception to be present in everything that doesn't want to falter when moving, but it isn't. Haining describes experiments that demonstrate conclusively that we are the only primates with a sense of rhythm, possibly deriving from advanced beat perception. Only strong social animals, he writes, from songbirds and parrots to elephants and humans, have beat perception. Isn't that amazing? What if musicality was acquired by all pre-social species through processes of convergent evolution? Like some other cognitive scientists, Honing now wonders how language might derive from music. In similar way to our reading, uses much older neural structures to recognize contrasts and sharp corners. That's interesting. Honing must now test his exciting hypothesis, and if the evolving animals orchestra is how he responds to disappointment, we can't wait to see what he makes of his success. So that is quite interesting, large scale animals, surely whales song beat, whale music. I wonder if they've got a beat to it. And you've got the elephants using infrasound to communicate with each other over kilometres. They're using infrasound. Okay, thanks a lot. I'll get these two up.
podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.